Okay. Now, what we're going to be doing tonight is examining one part of a paper by Lin from early this year in the February 17th EIR called Connect the Dots, which a lot of people in this room would have looked at some point or other, which is a development of another paper called How to Capitalize Recovery, which we do have in the pamphlet form. If anyone's who's interested in finding out more. But at the start of Connect the Dots, Lin says that the most important of the concepts of the science of fiscal economy to be understood at the moment by policymakers is the true practical economic meaning of what Leibniz terms technology. That is, how technology acts in increasing the relative potential population density and, of course, the relation of that to the machine tool sector. And he develops it in part of a conception in this paper, which is why I brought this up, which is that the rate of return of investment in the economy is not the actual monetary return, but the scientific and technological progress you produce by that investment. Now, that's what the source of your profit is, of your investment. And the classic modern-day example of that, which Lin cites a lot, is JFK's manned moon landing, where the actual return and profit from that was not monetary, but a product, you know, of all the new sciences and technologies. What I'm going to do is examine the nature of a principle is in relation to Leibniz's calculus, and the relationship of technology to fiscal economy, which is, you'll see the connection at the end of this class.
So if we don't get it all the way, bear with you today.
No, we don't get something.
Yeah, just yell out. So I'm going to read three quotes by Lin from Connect the Dots, then we'll go through and examine them in a lot more detail. Alright, so here's the first one. The issue of all economics practice as science is the principal difference between man and ape. That difference is typified by the human act of discovery of a universal physical or comparable artistic principle by means of which humanity's physical power in and over the universe is increased in a qualitative way. So mankind, in whom ape-like qualities would not permit a planetary human population of more than some relatively few millions of living individuals, now represents over 6 billions. As I shall emphasize in the course of this present chapter of this report and in comparable locations, the nature of a universal physical principle, such as the principle of the use of fire, or Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation, or the mastery of nuclear fission and thermonuclear fusion, as the apparent ontological form of an infinitesimal. I mean this as I stress the common incompetence of the empiricists Descartes, Newton, and that among such of their mechanistically inclined followers as D'Alembert, de Moivre, Euler, and Lagrange, who denied historically the existence of Leibniz's infinitesimals. Whereas the greatest achievements in modern science since Kepler and Fermat have been those associated with a view opposite to their own, the view by Leibniz, and the circles of collaborators of Carl F. Gauss, Bernhard Riemann, and later such as Albert Einstein. Everyone get that? Okay, here's the second quote. Why is a universal physical principle always expressed experimentally and therefore mathematically as an infinitesimal in the sense of Leibniz's catenary cued universal principle of physical least action? What is this that is bounded only by a formal mathematical zero and is nonetheless a physically efficient experimental presence? Why is the argument made by D'Alembert, de Moivre, Euler, Lagrange et al. That the infinitesimal is imaginary not merely wrong but intrinsically silly? The best answer to that question is to be found by asking a relevant question. Where does Leibniz's conception of the infinitesimal originate, and why is that essential ontological conception absent from Newton's counterfeit claim to have produced a calculus comparable to the original discovery made previously by Leibniz? The calculus, which was developed originally by Leibniz and no one else, was a byproduct of Johannes Kepler's uniquely original discovery of universal gravitation. At the center of Kepler's conceptually vast approach to the experimental methods he developed for his purpose, there was one central mathematical problem with two aspects. One was the notion of the infinitesimal, as the Leibniz calculus defines it in a more refined way by its universal principle of physical least action. The other was the notion of a deeper meaning underlying the notion of experimentally defined physical functions of an elliptical form. In both aspects of the problem posed to future mathematicians by Kepler, the elliptical function which described the relationship of the orbiting of Mars and Earth with respect both to one another and to the Sun, showed that these elliptical functions could not be explained in terms of a simple elliptical cut of a cone. The often cited looping of the image of a Mars viewed from Earth is a convenient pedagogical event for the purpose of conveying a sense of the issue to the novice. Since in the first instance, the interval of action within the planetary orbit was both efficient and yet infinitesimal, Kepler proposed that future mathematicians develop a calculus for representation of the inner dynamic of the generation of the elliptical orbit. In the second instance, the elliptical form of the functions implied by the planetary system, the attempt to explain an elliptical orbit formally as a section cut through a cone, must be put aside. In the meantime, Fermat's resolution of the apparent discrepancy between reflection and refraction, through the discovery of an ontological rather than merely formal resolution, produced Fermat's principle of pathway of quickest action. Fermat's solution prompted the Paris collaboration of Christian Huygens and Leibniz on, among other subjects, this matter of the pathway of quickest time. This approach evoked the discovery of the calculus by Leibniz, and the subsequent Leibniz-Bernoulli development of the catenary tube natural logarithmic principle of universal physical least action. Everyone get that? We need to get a projector so I can put this. But we're going to examine that in more detail. In relationship to the calculus and to technology.
That's just a question.
The first quote was on the nature of it was on physical principles have the apparent ontological form of the infinitesimal within your visual scope of sense perception. And the second quote was, he starts off with the sentence, why is the universal physical principle always expressed experimentally and therefore mathematically as an infinitesimal in the sense of Leibniz's calculus? And there's a key quote there I probably should have pointed out. But the challenge that Kepler left was to develop a calculus for representation of the inner dynamic of the generation of the elliptical orbit. I'll come back to that. And the last quote, it's a pretty short one. In other words, you experience the infinite object, the universal physical principle, as something which you are inside. The action of that which you are inside then becomes quasi-visible to your cognitive machinery of sense perception as an infinitesimal. That infinitesimal is manifest as an effect which may appear in the very, very small, but nonetheless you cannot catch it as an object held in hand. It eludes your attempt to grasp it as a discrete object. Yet as an effect, it is there in a very efficient way, an experimentally demonstrable way. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go through this ontological paradox that Rich brought up in relation to the exact nature of a universal physical principle and its manifestation in nature, which I'm going to go through a couple of examples of this. We're going to go through Kepler's unsolved paradox, Fermat's discovery of the pathway of quickest time, and an example by Leibniz on the idea of motion. Okay. So we're going to look at what's referred to as the Kepler problem. and Lynn has emphasized in a number of locations that all scientific achievements over the past four centuries are directly related and were a development of this paradox originally posed by Kepler. Now, as some of you might know, actually, Hugh here has done work on measuring cosmographic and the new astronomy. I'll take that for a no. There are two books by Johannes Kepler. He's probably best known as the guy who worked out that the planets travel in elliptical orbits, not circles. And also discovered universal gravitation.
That's for another class.
Okay, now, as some of you might know, at the point where Kepler made his discoveries, there were three different models for the solar system in Europe, which were the model of Ptolemy, the model of Copernicus, and the model of Tycho Brahe. Now, very, very quickly, to give you guys an idea, the Copernican system, you had the sun in the center and all the planets moving around it. It's what's referred to as a heliocentric system. In Ptolemy's one, you had the same thing, but with the Earth as the center, and all the planets plus the sun going around the Earth. Then on Tycho Brahe's system, you had the Earth at the center, the sun going around the Earth, and all the planets turn around the sun. Right? And every one of these systems you could use to calculate where a planet would appear in the sky within a hair's breadth of accuracy. Like, all of them would calculate within very, very close range of each other where different planets would appear. So, one of the main things Kepler raises in his new astronomy is this question of truthfulness. It's how do you know which one's true when they all have exactly the same effect? Why should you believe, you know, Copernicus over Tycho Brahe, or why should you believe any of them? How do you know which one's true? So what he did was he sort of attacked it from a different standpoint. He revived the scientific method of Plato, and instead of looking at the efficient effects, the empirical sense perception of what's happening in the sky, he tried to determine what was the principle that's moving the planets in the first place. Because by determining the principle, you would be able to work everything else out, right? What I'm going to do is go through this very, very briefly, and this is really a class in itself. Actually, it's probably many classes in itself. What's worth of these are functions of whiteboard numbers. This is summer 1998. What Kepler did was he realized that the planet's motion is in the inverse ratio to its apparent distance from the sun. For example, if you take these two points, these are referred to as the aphelion and in the planet's orbit where it's at its furthest distance from the sun, and the other is called the perihelion. He scopes that that's where the planet is closest to the sun. And he realized that at perihelion, which is closest distance to the sun, the planet's orbit, the planet is traveling at its maximum speed. And inversely, when the planet is at its maximum distance from the sun, it travels at its slowest speed. You guys get that? So you're able to establish that these two variables are dependent. And as one changes, the other changes accordingly in a recent, in a certain pattern, even though it's unknown as at this point. And he, from this, was able to deduce or hypothesize that the speed at any point in this orbit is directly related to the distance back from the sun, right? Hypothesis, if you take any point on this orbit, the speed is directly related to how far the planet is from the sun at that point. So then you come to the question of, if you know the planet is here at a given time, how would you work out where it is at another given time in the future? So what he did is, if you take, say, these 2 points, Kepler discovered that the time taken was equal to the sum of the infinite number of radial lines along this section of the orbit. Everyone see what I mean? But then you come to a problem, which is, how do you add up an infinite number of lines? So Kepler realized that this corresponds to the area. This is where its equal area, equal time law comes from. That if the planet took, say, a month, you go from here to here on the orbit, if you then took an equal area, this is where it would be a month later. Then if you took another equal area, that's another month, etc. around the orbit, right?
So how would these paradoxes of that left other sciences with that? Yeah, you can measure from, say, point one to point B, point one.
Getting to that in a second.
Ah, okay, so that's a different one.
Well, this is what led him to the... Right, does everyone see what I'm getting at, this? The planet will traverse, trace out an equal area, and its orbit. Then you come to a problem, because the orbits and ellipse, how exactly do you work out the precise area over any given time? I'll show you. Well, if you have planetary orbit,
what's that?
Okay, so say hypothetically that the planets travel from here to here. So this would be the corresponding area tracing out, right? Now that is equal to this circular area minus this triangle. This is where the sun is. So the area trace out is.
What's the clear part of the ecology?
Now, well, this is the center of the circle. Kepler mapped the orbit onto a circle.
So why would you minus the circle and minus that information?
So if you took the entire circular area and took away this triangle, that would be the corresponding area trace out. Yeah. Right. So what Deb would do is he developed the formula for another formula that it needs to work in the south. Calculate the area of a strike, right? Start the high. The problem you get is that the high is equal to the sine of this angle. This vertical line here changes constantly as the angle increases or decreases. Like, for example, this angle, this is about 45 degrees, and it's already up about 3/4 of the way up, right?
So it changes
unconstantly up. So you come up with this paradox of how do you work this out?
That's called the Deppler paradox.
So what Kepler did was he called for a geometry which would represent the inner dynamic of generation of the orbit asphalt. Given that no matter what instant you take in the planet's movement, its speed, its direction, and its distance from the sun all change, no matter what, how small the interval you take is. Even if it's infinitesimal. Lin said you could define it as an elliptical function, but not in the sense of a cut of a cone. Like taking a plane and cutting a cone of it, so you get a different point section.
It's going to be an infinitesimal variation.
Well, you could, I mean, you could generate an ellipse in that manner, but you couldn't explain how the planet knows where the orbit is. People have a sense of what I'm getting at, this relationship between the generation of the orbit, even though all the variables change in every single instance of time you take.
It's the fallacy of
So now we're going to look at a similar example with a similar ontological paradox, which is the case of Pierre de Fermat. Now, what Lin referred to before is the fact that Fermat was able to resolve a paradox that arose between reflection and refraction. Right? Because when you have a light beam that's no, this is something Lin referenced in the thing that I was looking into. It sort of touches on it for maybe 5 minutes. But when you have a mirror, and a light beam hits that mirror, it reflects at an angle equal to what it struck the mirror at. Okay? Everyone's seen this before? But when you have the case of light entering or exiting one medium and going into another, you have a completely different or seemingly different phenomenon where the light bends. Okay. It's a commonplace example you'll come up with this in everyday life. It's where you have a straw in a drinking glass and the light seems to bend when you're looking at the glass sideways. But the straw comes down and it seems to be cut in half and leap over. So, the way Fermat tackled this is he asked a similar question by Kepler did. Kepler asked the question of what's moving the planets out of the planets know where they're going. distinction between what Plato refers to as efficient and divine causes. What he said was, how would the Creator have created the universe such that this happens as opposed to something else? And I've got a quick quote by Plato on this from the Timaeus, which I thought I'd read since the Lim read through this a couple of weeks ago. Plato says in the Timaeus, "These are the elements of necessity which the Creator received in the world of generation when he made the all-sufficient and perfect creature, meaning the universe, using the secondary causes as his ministers, but himself fashioning the good in all things. There are two sorts of causes, the one divine, meaning referring to the Creator's will, the other necessary, and we should seek to discover the divine above all, and for their sake, the necessary, because without them the high cannot be attained by us." So if Amar asks that same question which Plato has in the Timaeus, of since God created the universe to be perfect, what is the most perfect thing for light to do when going through another medium? And he hypothesized that the light is travelling at a finite speed. So when it slows down, has to find the quickest pathway to travel to account for that change. Everyone get that? Yeah. He hypothesized that light is traveling at a finite speed, and as it slows down or speeds up, when I'm passing through into the second medium, it finds the pathway of quickest time.
Isn't that because that second medium changes its function of the body? It's going to have different densities of whatever, oxygen, or else. Mm-hmm. It's going to have different reactions.
Well, it changes the speed of light, but why does it light just keep going like this at a slow speed? Why is it? Because, like, if it was traveling between these two points, Lamar was able to prove that this is the quickest path between those two points. They have the same question. How does light know where the quickest path is?
Can you prove this?
No. Well, what he proved was that the angles the sine of these two angles is in inverse proportion to the densities of these two mediums. And that proportionality is constant no matter what angle the light hits the second medium. I can show you a proof later. In fact, I'll prove it using the jacket. Leibniz has a proof in one of his papers. But it's the same question, right? How does light know where the quickest pathway is when does everyone see what I'm getting at?
Okay.
Now, I'm going to show one more example of this by Leibniz. The reason I brought up those two was that these were paradoxes which provoked the development of the calculus by Leibniz. And this is Leibniz brings this up about 20 locations as a refutation of Newton's idea of momentum.
Newton's idea of what?
Momentum.
Oh.
I think so, yeah. It's also going to say on Dynamics. He has a paper called A New System of the Communication Between Substances and the Relationship of Between the Soul and the Body, or something like that, where this comes up. He has it's in lots of locations. It's also in the Discourse on Metaphysics. You have two masses. You call this body A and B, right? Such that this is a mass of 1 pound and this is 4 feet. And this is a mass of 4 pounds and this is 1 foot. Saying that taking this and lifted it 4 feet, and taking a 4 pound weight and lifted it 1 foot. So, according to Newtonian momentum, these would both have exactly the same quality of momentum when they fall, right? This way Newton defines momentum is mass times velocity. So what Leibniz says is he'll make two suppositions. In the first place, that a body falling from a certain height acquires enough force to enable it to remount to the same height, provided that its direction is turned that way, and provided there are no hindrances. And this is Leibniz. So for example, with a pendulum, if you lifted a pendulum to a certain height, there was no air resistance or anything like that, it would require enough force as it's falling to raise it to exactly the same height. Right? Then he said, secondly, I suppose in the second place that it will take as much force to lift the body weighing 1 pound to height of 4 feet as to raise a second body weighing 4 pounds to the height of 1 foot. So it will take the same amount of force to lift both of these bodies, their respective heights. It is therefore manifest that the body, A, falling 4 feet, requires exactly as much force as body B, falling 1 foot, having by the first supposition sufficient force to return to the top. It is therefore manifest that BA, falling from the height CD, requires exactly as much force as the body B, falling from the height EF. For the body B at F, having by the first supposition enough force to return to E, has therefore the force to carry a body of 4 pounds to the distance of 1 foot EF. And likewise the body A, at D, having the force to return to C, has also the force required to carry a body weighing 1 pound its own weight back to C, a distance of 4 feet.
The top mass up there of A, I should call that this scale.
And the amount of force it acquires is the same it would take to lift that body back up to the height. Right. And that the same is true for the second body. This is what Leibniz is saying.
Is he not?
He's saying that force. Which is different to the idea of momentum.
What the way I understand this is like, well, if you are hit by a piece of metal that weighs 1 gram and falls 2,000 kilometers per hour.
I'm getting to that in a second.
It's like 1 gram. 1,000 kilometers per hour, and then you have a weight of 2,000 grams, 2 kilograms
explain the second.
This is what happened here on the board as well. You just say that the
Right. Well, Leibniz has laid this out as a hypothetical situation. The reasons such shall soon be apparent. Now, by the second supposition, the force of these two bodies is equal. Let us now see if the quantity of motion is the same in each case. It is here that we will be surprised to find a very great difference, for it has been proved by Galileo that the velocity acquired to fall CD is double the velocity acquired by the fall EF, although the height is four times as great. Get that? Because by Newton, these would have exactly the same force. But Galileo proves that when a body falls, it falls in the inverse square of the distance. Like the speed is the inverse square of the distance. So this body would have twice as much as that one.
This is not the case of resistance.
No, but for pedagogical purposes. So, Leibniz says that we can see, therefore, how the force ought to be estimated by the quantity of the effect which it is able to produce. For example, by the height to which a body of certain weight can be raised. This is a very different thing from the velocity which can be imparted to it, and in order to impart to it double the velocity, it must have double the force. Then he goes on to how Descartes and Newton have all fallen to error in this question. But what he's pinpointed is that, and he develops this in a number of other papers, like his Discourse on Metaphysics and Essay on Dynamics, that there's an efficient capacity for action inherent in both these objects, which you can't see, even though you can prove experimentally that it's there. That. And this was somewhat bastardized by Newton, particularly in his Optics, where he introduced this idea of potential energy. Empirics, yeah.
One question, just in a definition, what does Newton say about this?
Newton says, well, they invent this mysterious term with no real experimental backing. What they say is that momentum is equal to mass by velocity.
Yeah, I know that from school, but what is physics?
Well, the idea is that you would have heard Newton's idea of inertia. It's a rule that if a body is stationary, it will remain stationary unless there's some force imparted on it.
Yeah.
Or inversely, if a body is moving, it will continue moving at the same velocity, in the same direction, unless some outside force changes its direction and speed. And the example Noah brought up, this idea that, which Bruce also brought up in the class in LA, the voyage back in Melbourne, you might have said, that if you had a car weighing, say, a ton, travelling at 1 kilometre an hour, and it hit you, it wouldn't do you much damage, right? It's only travelling at 1 kilometre an hour. But if you had a mass of one kilogram travelling at 1,000 kilometres an hour, and that hit you, there's a full data difference there, right? Yeah, but Andy, can you get me a coffee? But for Newton, in Newton's mechanics, they have exactly the same 40 momentum, so you treat them both identically. You treat them in exactly the same manner when you're analysing different hypothetical situations. Even though there's a qualitative difference in the effect they produce. Yeah, black pressure. And Leibniz is getting at the same thing here. correct? That if you look at the back-back juice, although you're exerting the same force to raise them, they have a different effect when they fall. So you have an inherent capacity for action that you can't sense, you can't perceive through your sensory apparatus. Within these bodies, it is qualitatively different.
Scientists still believe in this today.
In this, I was taught this in high school. I got into an argument with my teacher about it. I'll show you Leibniz's some of Leibniz's references to this.
This is the United Times.
But I mean, like, scientists today, I'm talking about school, like, past, like, actual science practices today, still probably just, like, fact based.
A lot of them do. If you ever organised or gone to a university and organised one of their professors, Grant Count Newton was a complete fraud. They love this guy. It's insane. Newton did not make a single original discovery. He just took existing discoveries like Kepler and Fermat and introduced formal mathematics to analyze, you know, all these different principles. And completely bastardized the discoveries. Sort of, yeah. Euclid's the same sort of thing. So what we've seen in these three examples is a common ontological paradox, right? Fourth worry, am I right? So, are there any questions? Actually, I've got a question. In relation to what we've just outlined, this idea of a principle, which is efficient yet unseen, what such principles are acting in our economy right now?
Invisible hand.
The invisible hand has our rights.
Not very efficient.
Yeah, that's not an efficient principle.
Cheers.
Because this is really the underlying concept of all science.
There's one language that's gravitation.
Speak. You elaborate?
Efficient and unseen.
It's good if you're not using gravity. It's an efficient principle that guides.
Gravity is acting now, huh?
Yeah. Gravity is common.
I'll go with that in technology. Because technology is efficient if it's actually done in the correct manner. I'm not using today's technology. But the principle of the unseen principle of impact of its effect, or knowing its effect, is unseen. You can't physically foresee that. We're saying until it's actually implemented, you can't really still see the effect of it.
Well, if I brought in a projector, you would see the effect.
How do you measure your economy?
I think my class is too rhetorical. People keep anticipating what I'm about to do. Can you add something to that?
I was just going to continue on Andy's ideas. Says the city wish that the sort of the unseen principle of technology being used in internal workings of machine. Probably what you're about to go into.
Well, I was about to tackle this the same way Leibniz did, by looking at the idea of continuity. What is the nature of continuity? Because you have to realize that, you know, with planetary orbit, there's a direct relationship between where the planet is and its speed, direction, and that sort of thing at any given instant, and the orbit as a whole. You have this direct relationship where, you know, if something changes, the rest changes accordingly. It's the same thing with light, right? So we're going to look at this question of continuity in relation to motion, which is how life is happening. Right? First of all, someone tell me what you think motion is. Change of what? Change of speed? Okay, so you're technically correct, haven't you?
Change of movement.
What did Andy just say? So you would agree that motion, which is a state of change, is a state of effect? That motion is a state of change? And that an object in this, that it's a state of a thing? I think it would be said to be in that state. You said that motion was a state of change, right? So, I would say that this is in that state. What's doing this? You get what I mean? Okay. Now, the example Leibniz gives in his motion dialogue is death. Dying is a state of change, right? Going from life to not life.
Well,
yeah. But is a person who is dying dead or alive? They're dying.
Still alive. I know what it is. Less alive
and
more dead
at the time. Chops half bulk. Say what?
Is he missing zero?
Zero?
Well, we have to ask for something.
If someone has just finished their graduate,
yeah, the end of the soul.
What was that really bad joke? How many times? Alright, Andy, tell us this joke.
Alright. Gary Jones told this joke.
You
have a baby that has died. The priest comes to his deathbed. He goes to one of the last rites. He says, before you die, you must renounce the devil and accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. He's just becoming more frantic. Son, you're dying. You haven't got much time to go. You have to renounce Satan and accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. He's still son. He says, what's wrong with you?
Anyway, on this subject of dying, there's a couple of things you can immediately say, right? That since a person's losing their life, there's some last moment there where they still had it. Right? It's a last moment before they suffer the loss of life. And inversely, since they're beginning to be taken death, there's a first moment when they're dead. So the question is, are these two moments the same? And which one would you ascribe the state of change to?
When is that change to be before it's dead?
Yep. Well, first of all, are these two moments the same? Do they coincide? Well, not simultaneous, but the same. It's just the same moments that we're identifying. What do you think? Well, they couldn't be the same, right? So that would mean the person is both dead and alive at the same time.
The answer is the paradox is the same.
that's gave him the boxes and said.
That's why I say it simultaneously. At the moment you suffer your last infinitesimal breath, you enter your pass through the state of the first moment of death. Or like of actually being dead. Because dying is only a process of change. But being dead is the end result of that change. So you are alive through the process of dying. So there's an instant, sort of like instantaneous movement somewhere that the last infinitesimal of your life is the same time as the processes of being dead.
Last infinitesimal moment? But wouldn't that mean the person is both dead and alive at that moment?
It's impossible. Well, it's like the orbit rate line. If you think about it, there again, where they have you, at what point does the planet start slowing down instead of speeding up? Can it be slowing down and speeding up at the same time?
Yeah, that's the same thing.
Or the opposite way, when does it start speeding up instead of slowing down?
Well,
it's the same question.
Does anyone else have an idea? What Leibniz says, this idea of life and death, is that these two moments couldn't be the same. Because that would mean that a person is dead and alive at the same time, which is absurd. But they couldn't be a point apart, because that would mean there's a point there where the person is neither dead nor alive. So that they coexist next to each other, such that there are no gaps in between. You have one moment followed by another one, where the person's alive and dead. And you can apply this sort of idea of continuity to things like the planetary orbits. From the case of the aphelion and perihelion, there would be a moment where it's slowing down, followed instantly by one where it's speeding up, or inverse.
That's the same sort of thing that discussion was bringing up with the sage-wish.
So I was bringing this up.
Yeah, he was going like that. It's like waking up, it's on the side, there's obviously it's not a continuous motion that has to be in time, like it's slowed down. It has to speed up, like it's not.
So you're saying it's not quite at speed, you get going like this. Yeah. Like, you get on a point where you have our mass to slow down and it's hard because it's a snap off, right? Same like that. So it has to be faster to slow down.
Yeah. And then Leibniz, the other example he brought up was the idea of getting wealthy. Right? If you had a homeless derelict and one of those doormans at the metro, and you gave him a penny, he wouldn't be rich. But if you gave him another penny, he still wouldn't be rich. But if you kept doing that, eventually you would reach some point where he's suddenly wealthy, right? If you gave him enough pennies. But that change of state from poor to wealthy would be, that actual change would be created by the addition of only one penny. Right? So you have a point there where you add a minimum and that creates the change, or the change of the state.
So maybe we should save up all my pennies.
Well, the proper will soon be valuable. Okay. Now, to prevent a misconception, Leibniz has not identified here material atom-like points in space. But what he refers to as atoms of substance. Well, an atom is something physical, right? A change of state is not physical. It has a physical effect, but it is not in itself physical. Like, if you had something moving, you would say that this is an effect of motion. Well, what is motion itself? What is... You cannot grasp motion as an object. Okay? So when you say there's a point where this speeds up or slows down, That is not a physical point. Yeah, well, if you have an object in motion, like this is in motion, right? But you can't grasp motion as an object. Because motion is not an object in itself. I mean, we perceive the effects of motion, but we can't see motion itself. It's like gravity, right? You can see the effects of gravity, but you cannot, you know, grab gravity as a discrete object. See what I'm getting at? And Leibniz says it, well, he's pretty hard on the fact that it's the same thing with motion. You cannot see motion per se. What you're seeing right now is the effect of motion. Get that? And the example Leibniz gives with these two points next to each other, in his motion dialogue, is if you imagine you have a sphere. Have a ball resting on the top of this box. Now, a Euclidean geometer or an empiricist would say that there's a point of contact between those two objects, right?
A point.
And there really isn't, there's two. You have a point on the sphere, which is touching a point on the table.
Okay.
It
just sounds like semantics.
I know.
It's completely different, though.
Yeah, I know.
Say it again.
Well, if you have a sphere resting on the table, a Euclidean geometer or a Newtonian or one of these empiricist nuts would say that there's a point of contact between the two objects.
Yeah.
In reality, there isn't. There's two. You have a point on the sphere touching a point on the table.
But then they are right. They just forgot to say that there was another point of contact, which was actually that one. That one point that contacted the second point, if it wasn't,
well, that's
oh,
two
never
points.
Mind.
That's 2 points.
No, but it becomes one point when it touches each other.
Is it 2 points or 1 point contact?
That's a contradiction in fact.
But Adam,
because that
mean...
would mean that there's a point between them, and that it's sort of levitating 1 point above the table, right? It's like, whenever you put an object down, it's always 1 point levitating.
This is not a bad.
Oh, no.
Andy, can you get me a coffee?
It's a horrible.
I have a point.
This is an actual question. What's the point of pointing out the fact that there is one point?
Well, this is Leibniz's example to help you conceptualize this idea. That when you have a change of state, and you have 1 point next to another point, the idea we were just discussing, this is the same thing. You say it's 1 point, it's a common fallacy, but a fallacy nonetheless. And he uses this as a metaphor to explain the fact that you don't have 2 points coinciding, but next to each other.
Describe a tangent to the circle would be the same process. It doesn't touch the circle at 1 point, but it's actually 2 points.
Well, what you see is a discrepancy between reality and Euclidean geometry. Because in Euclidean geometry, they would be at the same point, but in reality, that doesn't happen.
I said, think
that as two different points which connect to each other, such that there is no gap in between them.
Because it's not like a point on the circle or a point on the table or whatever. You know, as soon as they touch, they become they fuse together or something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's an assumption that you would need symbols to be correct.
Okay, and something I thought I'd bring up was, has everyone here seen LaRoche's book, The Science of Christian Economy?
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah, sure, you can grab a copy. This was something which Leibniz received a lot of criticism for. And there were several refutations of this, including one by Euler, which Ling wrote a refutation of that refutation in the back of The Science of Christian Economy.
So he refuted this as a thing as of
Euler? Well, what Euler said... this idea of infinite divisibility. But you can keep on dividing the line equally, ad infinitum. Same sort of thing, right? And Ling criticizes this at the back of... Where did that book just go? I was just going to show it so you can... Yeah, at the back of this one of the appendix. It's Appendix 11. Where Lin argues that, first of all, you need to recognize that there is a qualitative difference between what you see, the astrophysical domain, and the microphysical domain. Like, there's a qualitative difference between well, how we perceive them. But principles are universal. Any principle which is active in the microphysical domain is also active in our scope of ordinary sense perception, as well as in the astrophysical domain. Right?
Is the astrophysical domain a sense macro?
Well, macrophysical, yeah. Maybe. Very, very, very big. So then he says that his argument is that because principles are active in all three domains, the fact that you approach boundary conditions when going from our ordinary scope of sense perception to the macro domain, for example, with light, there's a boundary condition, which is the speed of light. The existence of those sorts of boundary conditions would prove that similar boundary conditions exist when you go from our scope of observation to the micro scale. That although it may appear to us that we can keep doing this, eventually you will reach a boundary condition which prohibits you from going any further. Everyone get that?
Yeah. You're saying that it appears in Euler's definition that you can keep going and going and going because you can divide it and divide it and divide it and divide it. But in reality, you can't because the boundary doesn't allow it.
Yeah, well, eventually you will reach some sort of boundary which prohibits you from going any further.
Okay.
I understand it's
information,
it's like technology,
you can relate them, but in the sense we're getting at this, it's different. This is off topic, so I'll do this very, very. Those of you who don't know, Archimedes,
he was right.
back at the area of the circle, which will be the infinite number of triangles. Going around is backwards. Right? He was able to prove, using the Socratic method of exhaustion, so although you're more closely approximating it, there's a difference between a circle and a polygon. It's a paradox, because the closer you get to the circle's area, the more angles you have on the polygon. So the further removed you are from the idea of a circle. That's the answer.
So how does that differ though?
Obsessed with in his refutations of Leibniz's monads. That's different to Coase's argument. Lin argues that there's a boundary condition where the Lin argues that there's a boundary condition as you keep subdividing. And Coase argued that you could not approximate the area of a circle with a polygon, because the circle is a higher species of shape. That is correct.
Is that essentially the same argument that you reach get a rich value condition? Boundary condition of the circle being that the further you move away, the more angles you move at, the further you're away from the circle itself.
Yeah.
Principle of boundary condition. The same sort of idea.
That's why I said you could relate them, but what I was getting at before was a bit. Okay. Now we're going to look at one more example of motion to illustrate more clearly and to tie all this in together. And we're going to use an example from Leibniz's essay on dynamics, which sort of gets closer to this idea of the infinitesimal. And if you want to find out more, you should really hunt these down, because I'm only scratching on the surface of rotating. And imagine you had a ball inside the cylinder. As the cylinder rotates, there'll be a force which will make the ball move outside the cylinder. Starts to move out. my mentor. Didn't you start your... So you said that the ball was moving due to its momentum. How does it get that momentum?
Tension.
The ball knows that the cylinder is going to rotate and move this way.
Operating the machine or whatever it is coming out.
It's the one that says that the effort of the ball tending towards the end of the cylinder. It's infinitely small in relationship to the momentum it already has. But the actual effort, making the ball move this way towards the end of the cylinder, is infinitely small in relation to its motion. Or inversely, the motion is infinitely greater than the effort which is making it move to the end of the cylinder. The effort that the ball has, which makes it start to move to the end of the cylinder, is infinitely small. Compared to the momentum of the ball, or the quantity of motion that the ball has. Actually, I can read you out the quote, which might. He says, it is obvious that at the beginning of the Conatus, which is Latin, similar to the word effort, at the beginning of the Conatus, of proceeding from the center, the Conatus, namely, by which the ball tends toward the end of the tube, is infinitely small with relation to the impetus, which is Newtonian momentum, which it already has from the rotation, or that by which the ball tends to the end of the tube itself. So the effort, the capacity for action within the ball, is infinitely small in relation to the ball's motion. Get that? As you start to rotate, the effort of the ball moving is infinitely small in relation to the motion it already has. Say what? And the effort, if it doesn't have motion, and you don't start moving the cylinder, it won't move. Yeah, we're saying that the cylinder is in the process of moving. Sort of see what I'm getting at? Then he says that if you continue this rotation for some time, there will arise within the ball from its own progression a certain centrifugal momentum comparable to the momentum of the rotation. The ball will accelerate to a quantity of motion equal to that of the rotating of the cylinder.
people are saying the relationship between the area swept down on the planet and so you said the distance from the planet to the sun is the, you're going to find out, you're going to find out the time that it's actually traveled, so you can actually find out how the time that it's sent to the
You know what I was bringing up before? The idea of the planet, already knowing where its orbit is.
Yeah.
And similar idea with light, knowing the quickest pathway. But the ball doesn't have the same sort of sense. Well, it does in a way, but in, like, it has an inherent capacity for action. But it doesn't... Actually, I'll get back to this in a second. Have you read Leibniz's Discourse of Metaphysics, an essay on dynamics? I'm going to email you a whole list.
You may as well email me as well.
You may stick a metaphysics in that too. You know, my first is that's right. Otherwise, it's.
I do intend on teaching class on patterning at some point. So Leibniz says that the effort of this ball is twofold. There's an elementary, or infinitely small one, and one formed by a continuation or repetition of this infinitely small effort. So if you think of the tube rotating, if you take an instance, and you add up how much speed is increasing at each of those instants, the speed of that instant would be infinitely small as compared to the quantity of motion it achieves. And those who have done work in the calculus should see what I'm getting at.
Okay.
So I'm going to read out a quote.
He's discussing like the infinitely small, the infinitely large maximum limit theorem, stating that really what makes something infinitely small is the fact that the quantity of zero is infinitely large in comparison to it. And the same as if the infinitely large in comparison to the infinitely small, which way below zero, is the highest quantity of one, which is quantity. The difference between quantity and nothingness.
You know, that example I gave before of a person getting wealthy one penny at a time?
Yeah, yeah.
The penny would be the example of what's called a minimum. Yeah. That is something which is indivisible, which has no past. Right. So, for example, with what we were looking at with the sphere on the table as a metaphor for two points coexisting in a state of change,
like, yeah.
those two points would be minimums.
Yeah.
But they're indivisible or infinitesimal in Carnot sense.
In relation to this?
In relation to this? Well, if you can imagine the cylinder rotating,
yeah.
You take an instance. The effort of the ball tending towards the end of the tube at that instant is what Leibniz refers to as an infinitesimal.
So it's an infinitesimal.
Or would they? Do people sort of see what I'm getting at? The action of the ball at any given
instance
is infinitely small in relation to the quantity of motion that the ball has.
If you're looking at the, say, from one instance,
and that the ball gains from the continual rotation. Or, in other words, the total quantity of motion that the ball gains from this rotation is the sum or equal to the aggregate of all these infinitesimal impulses. It's all these infinitesimal efforts, if you will, of the ball tending towards the end of the moment. So, are there any questions on this? It's either quote by Leibniz, which I put in here. I thought this would clear something up. I think we ought to get Larry Norman in that context. So I'm going to read out a quote from a paper by Leibniz called A New System of the Nature and the Communication of Substances, as well as the Union Between the Soul and the Body. It says, and this is after a discussion along similar lines to this one. It says, it is only atoms of substance, that is to say, real unities that are absolutely destitute of parts, which are the sources of action and the absolute first principles out of which things are compounded, and as it were, the ultimate elements in the analysis of substance. One could call them metaphysical points. They have something vital in a kind of perception. And mathematical points are the points of view from which they express the universe. But when a corporeal substance is contracted, all its organs together make only one physical point with respect to us. Physical points are thus indivisible in appearance only. Or mathematical points are exact but are nothing but modalities. It is only metaphysical points, or points of substance, constituted by forms or souls, which are exact and real. And without them there would be nothing real, since there could be no multitude without true unities. Everyone get that? So these instants you take, are you ready? One second. I have to have something to drink. It is only atoms of substance, that is to say, real unities that are absolutely destitute of parts, which are the sources of action and the absolute first principles out of which things are compounded, and as it were, the ultimate elements in the analysis of substance. One could call them metaphysical points. They have something vital and a kind of perception, and mathematical points are the points of view from which they express the universe. Well, he calls them metaphysical in the sense that they do have a real efficient existence, but they can't be perceived through your sensory apparatus. And he says that they have a kind of perception.
They have a kind of what?
Perception. And mathematical points are the points of view from which they express the universe.
Mathematical points are what?
Are the points of view.
Of
view.
V-I-E-W.
From which they express the universe.
So some sort of unity he's talking about, like...
One second. So in relation to this, mathematical points would be the infinitely small, and this is how they express themselves in relation to the universe. But when a corporeal substance is contracted, all its organs together make only one physical point with respect to us. Physical points are thus indivisible in appearance only, while mathematical points are exact but are nothing but modalities. It is only metaphysical points or points of substance constituted by forms or souls which are exact and real, and without them there would be nothing real, since there could be no multitude without true unities. Yeah, mathematical points are exact, but are nothing but modalities.
What's modality?
Andy, you've got a defining term. Sort of, yeah. Purpose of this pedagogy, think of it as something similar to what Lynn brings up, this idea of singularity. That is, it's generated by a physical transformation that has no efficient inherent existence by itself. Right. But do people understand that? Saying that the metaphysical point is a unity in itself. This, for example, the effort at any given instance would be a metaphysical point. Okay. You sort of get that? I'll get you a copy of this. It's definitely worth reading. In fact, once this class is over, everyone should wipe to their computer. Demonstrated this idea of the metaphysical point in the Keplerian orbit and the idea of light traveling at a finite speed, where the planet knows where it's going and the light knows the quickest pathway, is in a sense an inherent capacity for action which is more real than what we see through our sensory apparatus. It's a theme which Wing brings up in a couple of places. Sort of, yeah. Actually, yeah. And this is what Kepler brings up in the New Astronomy, where he brings up the idea of the planet having an intention. That it knows where it's going. Right? This idea of having a metaphysical, what Leibniz calls a metaphysical point at every instant. And what we're going to do is relate everything I've just laid out to you back to economics.
Right.
Is that like
So let me pose a question to you guys. What are the unseen principles in an economy which effectively govern what we see? What are the unsensed principles? And I mean that in the context of principles which are efficient but unseen in an economy, acting at every instant, which govern what we say. Energy. Elaborate on that.
In terms of energy, right? To the idea of efficiency, right? In terms of, it's not the right term.
It's the concentration of power,
yeah.
And that's governing our economy.
Cool. Yeah, we're looking at a hypothetical economy, not 1%.
Hypothetically, if our economy was actually functioning, not about to crash,
it would be one of the unseen.
First of all, I'm going to make a distinction here. The financial data you see is a reflection or a shadow of the actual physical processes in the economy. So the question I'm asking is really, what is governing the physical processes? Rob's very, very eager.
Would this be, one aspect of this be the confirmation of principles which we have discovered scientific research?
In a sense, yeah. Or more specifically, it's the application of those principles, right? The problem is that Webb skipped something at the moment, which is how do you judge an economy? Have people here heard the term relative potential population density? What this term means, you all know what a population means, right?
How many people?
What you're looking at is what your population density could potentially become relative to the fact that you have different qualities of land. Yeah. looking at this is our judgment economy, and this is continually changing. Relate what I said before back to this. What principle is unsensed through our sensory apparatus, active in an economy, which is governing this? People see what I'm getting at? You see what I'm getting at?
What can we do to say the desert? What can we do to set the desert to actually make it more inhabitable for a high potential of people to live there? To change the climate, to change the agriculture potential.
And my question was, how would you, what principle governs your potential population density in the economy? And there's a lot of different examples you can use of this around the world right now. Like in Ibero-America, their potential population density, or their relative potential population density, is lower than their population. Or in other words, they don't have the ability to support what their population is at the moment. That's why you have people dying. And we're saying you should have the reverse effect, where you have the ability to support, you know, many magnitudes more than what your population is at the moment, relative to the different land technology available.
The lecture says that the work with the technology we have, even though we're not using it in application, the land that we have, the land mass, can actually sustain some of the
trillion.
Trillion
or billion? There it is.
150 trillion people are going on.
Maybe it's a billion.
And that's why Malthusian is crazy.
I don't even think that's one square kilometer.
Yeah,
he says.
Well, what I was getting at before and what I was... What is it?
It's just 1970, just in North America alone, potential population density should have been 25 billion people.
In North America?
Yeah.
I remember, I think that was 25 billion. I remember there was a study by Fusion magazine into this where they went through all the different data very thoroughly. Yeah, as accurate a figure as possible.
It says, had the world as a whole employed to the degree it's might have done so, the levels of technology already available by 1970, not only would the planet's population be significantly larger than it is, the average standard of living per capita would approximate that of North America in 1970, and potential population data distinct from the actual would be approaching 25 billion.
That's for the whole world.
Sorry. Anyway, what I was getting to is that this is governed by technology. Right? The relative potential population density is governed by technology. And the way you develop new technologies is through discoveries of principle of the universe. And yeah, by applying that to the population, assimilating those into your economy as a whole. Okay? So the example, with the examples I gave before, this idea of the planet and the light being, as Bruce Director has pointed out, I think it's room for any numbers. You can use that to demonstrate that cognition is an active principle everywhere in the universe. Right? Including in our economy right now. In relation to the cognitive abilities of your individual factory worker at General Motors about to get kicked down the street, and his ability to create, you know, his abilities of creativity to discover new principles and apply them as technology has an effect on the economy as a whole.
Accept a new technology, a new scope called
That's from the century, sir. There's a famous painting of Papin, the guy who invented the steam powered steam engine, where he had a boat with a steam powered engine. This very famous painting, which is in a lot of our material in the 21st century now, of him trying to get this boat going, having a whole bunch of foremen trying to destroy the machine, thinking it's going to steal their jobs. Ben, of course.
Who's the foreman?
But the thing is that if that machine stole like 5 jobs, if it could do the work of 5 men, I can guarantee it would take more than 5 men to build and design that machine.
This is probably happening to the country leaders today because of lack of education and technology. A machine to do bits of work, taking our jobs, the machine is taking our jobs. But the thing is, as Adam has pointed out, the fact is that it's still like, these people that lose their jobs and the machine to do it can actually be completely online and form of actually designing this. Like, for the skill that they know in terms of operating this aspect of the factory which they work at, they know what needs to be done. The physical energy from the human being needs to be done to produce this product. They can actually design a machine that's efficient to do it. That's a higher capacity of jobs than a high or a comfortably driven place of employment.
It's a good thing to set up a company in which A, you get more efficient product, but B, you get safety to work.
My next question. What is the relationship between that individual worker and the economy's whole? I'm going to keep asking for you to elaborate on your textbook answers.
So, what did you say?
I said you could pass up on.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, the point that the discovery that they made as one human being steered the whole economy. Might be very, very small, but the animal is smaller. You take integral discoveries being made by the individual, applicable, and the
say just transmitting the discovery to one worker makes a discovery to apply a key, communicates this to his fellow workers, and they apply it in their factory. That's setting a standard for, okay, why is this factory so much more productive than one down the road? It's not doing that. I have to look at what's different, what has changed the potential of this in terms of applying it in other places with actually transmitting the discovery.
Let me ask a similar question. How can you tell if what you're doing right now is changing history?
Because the principle is,
it's easy when you look back, right? I mean, I can look back now and say that the intervention at the 2004 Boston Democratic Convention changed history.
This is after
the time. Well, Lynn knew it at the time. Lynn was saying at the time, this is going to change history. And if you look at what that created politically, we actually did change history with that intervention. But how can you look at what's happening right now and know if you're changing history?
I mean, right now, as we're sitting here right now?
Yeah. What's the relationship between this infinitesimal instant and the integral, the sum of those instants?
So you've actually come up with this graph, and you've actually provided us, all of this is a tool which we can harness in our own minds in terms of applying this.
Elaborate.
Well, say the idea of potential relative population density that you just communicated to us, especially people that haven't studied in economics, actually work your way, actually understanding for experience of yourself that there is a higher principle of cognition within everything we do within our economy. You've given us a sense of this knowledge. So really, like, it's better than just sitting down watching Simpsons or something.
The
say that what I'm getting at is really the same idea?
Alright. So what do you think the relationship of a worker is to them?
To the economy is that? Because if you grow a lot of bling, there are points in it. He occasionally brings up this idea. He says, what sort of Keplerian orbit is the economy on? Like he brings up Keplerian orbit as a metaphor for an economic forecasting.
How can you take this idea of the intention and curvature of orbit and say, in fact, that you have these metaphysical points, which the planet knows it's going to go to? Acting
with the economy and work out the metaphysical points
which
it's going to
take, given the principles that are acting.
So Glenn looks at the rate of inflation. Since our poll come from 2005, we had 25% rate of inflation, and the first 3 months of this year, up 26%. First 2 weeks of April, up 16%. So if you're looking at the rate at which things are changing, knowing that you can actually forecast that in September, but the third quarter things are going to crash. This is looking at the orbit, what's the generating principle of why things are speeding up.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that as a metaphor, just the sun is the crash and the planet, like, the fact is that because things are, like, the inflation is getting so much faster, it pushes inflation, the crash, it's going to push the sun, which is going to be faster than the planet.
The only mathematics I've put up is the area of the circle, which is on the sine topic, and Kepler's means of calculating the equal areas. This is a class of calculus with no mathematics in any real sense, even though I did show you what the difference was.
It could be an economic process.
Change in motion in the planetary orbits, especially the Earth-Mars-Sun relationships, was so small that the interval was virtually non-existent. Hence, the notion of the infinitesimal calculus. Second, that the orbit was not merely elliptical in the sense of a steady cross-section of the cone, but that the rate of generation of the elliptical pathway had functional characteristics whose properties were not effective understood until the work of Gauss circles during the early 19th century. Moreover, Kepler had shown that the principle of action was so powerful that the effects expressed by this infinitesimal interval of action were manifest on the astrophysical scale. As I have already emphasized earlier here, with respect to Euler's folly, The relevant infinitesimal of an ontologically zero magnitude was the power over the solar system. The infinitesimal, contrary to a sophist, Augustin Cauchy, Andy Mulgrave, D'Alembert, Euler, Lambert, Lambert, Lagrange, and others before him, is a form of action which is very efficient, but is expressed experimentally as of not a very small finite magnitude, but contrary to Euler's ontological folly on this account, actually a virtually zero magnitude. All universal physical principles are expressed as universal physical principles in that same way. There is nothing to be properly deemed suspicious in this fact. As I have emphasized earlier in this report, the peculiarity of the experience of any truly universal physical principle is that it is universal, as extensive in its reach as the universe reaches. Therefore, its manifest existence in some particular expression cannot occur as an object peculiar to a particular locality, but is nonetheless manifest experimentally as a particular kind of local influence. It appears locally, therefore, only as an effect called a discontinuity of the visible domain. As Kepler's experimental demonstration of the solar orbits expresses influence as an infinitesimal at any chosen relevant point. Its local magnitude, expressed in a geometry of continuous functions, is necessarily zero, and yet it is a zero which expresses an efficient effect, and it is therefore a definite existence, even though its expressed linear magnitude in that interval is zero. That is the meaning of an infinitesimal in the Lyman's calculus, but not the dubious Cauchy version. The same applies in a special way to the boundary condition which distinguishes living from non-living processes, and which distinguishes human cognitive behavior as belonging to a different domain than the biospheres and the noosphere. This latter distinction is that which Bernard Riemann, writing in his posthumously published work on the subject of named Geistermaßen, after the style of the anti-Kantian psychology of classical education of Jean Frederick Herbert. All valid discoveries of efficient universal physical and classical artistic principles appear in the form of such crucial functional discontinuities within what is otherwise an obscene ostensibly continuous process. In effect, every such discovery which is expressible as such a discontinuity has the In effect, every such discovery which is expressible as a
discontinuity
has the locality expressed form of an infinitesimal. The way in which Leibniz's complementary original discoveries of both the catenary-linked principle of universal physical action and the functionality-related natural logarithmic functions came to be expressed as a simple as a special quality of geometrical function in the complex domain is a general expression of this. Every discovery of a universal physical or comparable principle expresses this same characteristic.
Okay, but it was the last paragraph. effect, every such discovery which is expressible as such discontinuity, as the locally expressed form of an infinitesimal. The way in which Leibniz's complementary, original discoveries of both the catenary linked principle of universal physical least action and the functionally related natural logarithmic functions came to be expressed as a special quality of geometric function in the complex domain, is a general expression of this. Every discovery of a universal physical or comparable principle expresses this same characteristic.
Yeah.
It's a very good paper. Therein's my class.